Ingram Smith, Bud Elliott, back again with another episode of the Nolcast. Bud, this is an episode that we've looked forward to. I know that you had secured a great guest for us about a week ago, and just this was the first night where our schedule would pair up, so excited to be able to bring people that, and we will have a little bit of a recruiting talk as we kind of make our way into the Jimbo Fisher camp, kind of the peak of the summer recruiting period for Florida State. So have a little bit of a change up tonight rather than the Louisiana Hot Sauce read. We will have Louisiana Hot Sauce facilitate this interview that you'll hear right now with a guest that we are very excited to bring to you.
Hey, y'all, and welcome back to the show. We are pleased now to have us joining us on the Louisiana Hot Sauce Hotline, Dennis Guile of the Quarterback Academy, one of the most renowned quarterback coaches in the country. Dennis, thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it, guys.
Absolutely. And just for y'all, if you want to know, you can visit QBAcademy.com. Dennis was a first-team all-conference quarterback at Central Missouri State. He held their best combined program record in the history at 20-4 and set a national passer efficiency record with a rating of 214. Dennis, 214. That is ridiculous.
We had some guys that could run really fast, and I could throw the ball really far. So when you do that and you get a lot of touchdowns that are 60, 70, and 80 yards, it kind of helps you out.
No doubt. So just for our audience, how did you get into the quarterback coaching game?
You know, after I was done with college, I was, you know, blessed enough to make it into camp with the Patriots and then go on to play 2 years in Canada with the Saskatchewan Rough Riders, and then 5 years of arena football here in Arizona, Utah, and then in Texas. And everywhere I played, I always went to either the best team or where they had the best quarterback or best coaching, and just got to learn from a lot of good guys and train at a lot of good facilities. And I knew when I was done playing that I really wanted to, you know, buy into these kids' lives and help them and give back what I learned. And so even when I was playing, I started training and, you know, really got lucky to work with some really good kids. And they started becoming, you know, some of the number one players in the country and doing this and that and getting scholarships. And so I said, you know what, this is going to be my full-time job when I was done playing. And even though I still was playing in my offseason, I was doing it. So that's how everything came about.
I remember the first time I met you, I mean, many years ago with the Elite 11, you were telling me about a kid named Kyle Allen. And you had texted me about him. You said, hey, you got to see this kid. He's legit. And, you know, since transfer to Texas A&M, obviously one of the hottest quarterback transfers, I think probably ever, landed at Houston, I believe, and should really tear it up there. But you've had a number of top prospects come through and work with you. What do you think is really the key to your success?
The relationship. You know, I care about these kids a lot. You know, I don't come from the best background, obviously, and the community I grew up in was, you know, you definitely had to be focused to make it out of there. And, you know, I had a lot of people that, family members that supported me and really cared for me and showed me what life was about. And, you know, it's great to be able to help a kid throw a football better or teach them how to read a defense or understand a protection. But when you can help a kid become a better human being, I think you're changing the world. And I think that's the biggest thing is that I truly care about the kids. And they, you know, they realize that. And, you know, once they do, you know, they're kind of in your program forever.
I know you're big on technology as well. Could you tell us a little bit about how you incorporate technology with your work?
You know, biomechanics are huge, and, you know, there's a lot of ways to kind of incorporate that, you know, through different machines and things like that. And, you know, there's things out on the market that, you know, can help build the brain as far as being able to chunk information where, you know, a lot of guys can only watch one or two things. But, you know, chunking is when your brain is able to see a whole big picture and everything in the middle of it. And I not only do I train quarterbacks, but I race sprint cars too. And so the reaction time, when you're in one of those and the things that I've done to be able to slow the, you know, your thinking process down is, you know, you got to be able to quiet your mind in high pressure situations. And so how do you do that? And so there's a lot of different things that help that, you know, that I use to, you know, put someone in a high pressure situation and say, listen, even though this is probably the most crucial situation you've ever been in your life, and it's probably the most stressful, this is the moment that you got to take a deep breath and realize, listen, this moment is not too big for me. I just got to take a deep breath. I got to just think about, you know, what I've been taught, just slow everything down, go through what I know, and everything will be okay at the end of the day. And, you know, because the more you tense up in anything you do, whether it's doing a podcast, whether it's trying to hit a baseball, whether it's, you know, driving a sprint car, whether it's just training a quarterback, that's a pro bowler that, you know, that could seem overwhelming for someone. The more you can just, you know, kind of sit back and let everything come to you and relax, the better off you're going to be. And so, you know, I've really bought into that motto, and I think it's worked, you know, over the past 11 years of doing this. And I don't really change what I do, and go all over the place. I kind of keep the same thing over and over and over again, because I mean, just like any, you know, just like any sport, you know, just like a golfer, you got to be consistent to be good. And if you're not consistent, then no one's going to want you around. And so that consistency means a lot to me.
Very, very interesting stuff, Dennis. Bud mentioned your resume, and you would certainly be somebody that we would want to talk to, regardless of who you had recently. But one of the particular reasons why we wanted to get you on tonight is because we know that you've worked with DeAndre Francois, and just curious as to how the two of you guys got connected.
So I met DeAndre when he was in high school. And DeAndre comes from a background that's a lot similar to mine, where he's went through some really rough situations and, you know, came out of, you know, a neighborhood that wasn't the greatest and had a lot of adversity in his life, and didn't let that affect him or bother him. And so just, you know, our relationship outside of football is different. You know, 9 times out of 10, if I'm talking DeAndre on the phone, it has nothing to do with the football. And I think that, you know, we've bonded really good. And I think, you know, when a kid's in that type of situation, it's hard to get their trust. But when you do, it's, you know, I don't see him as anything but a little brother of mine. And so when I met him, you know, his going into his junior year, it took a while to get that trust. But I think once I gained it and once he saw who I was as a person, you know, we probably talked 3 times a week on FaceTime. And I like mentoring him, and I like being a part of his life because he's a great individual, just not a great quarterback.
Absolutely. And, you know, he said a lot of really complimentary stuff on Instagram and Snapchat and all that, and obviously holds you in very high esteem. When he came to you out at the summer in Arizona, what was the primary focus on in his game on getting better? Was it footwork? Was it arm slot? What did you guys identify, I guess, together as, hey, this is the one thing, if we get this whipped, you're going to be so much better this year?
I mean, obviously, after the year he had last year and the poise he showed, it's going to be, I mean, it's always hard to top a season like that. But, you know, there are a lot of little things that when we watch film that I see that he could do to, you know, maybe get rid of the ball a little sooner and not take such punishing hits, or, you know, put his cleats in the ground a little bit more and use more power in his lower body instead of trying to use more of his upper body, really letting his arm, you know, get past his pocket instead of stopping his arm. It'd be almost like a golf swing, and you go to hit the ball, and right when you hit the ball, you stop that swing. Well, that's not going to be as effective if you just let that swing go all the way through. And, you know, that's the best way I can explain it is, you know, as a quarterback, you don't ever want to stop your arm because, first of all, you're tearing microfibers in your shoulder. But second of all, it becomes a lot easier when you just let it go, because there's no throwing motion in the world that's natural for the, you know, for a human, you know, anatomy. There's nothing in your body that's natural about throwing any type of ball. So it's the most natural way of doing it, and, you know, not tearing your arm up and making it a lot easier at the same time, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of people, well, I don't know how many people realize this, but he pretty clearly had some kind of injury going on last year. Do you feel like he's healthy? He's in a better spot now than he was maybe during the season?
Yeah, I mean, he has some nagging injuries, obviously, with the shoulder and, you know, a couple other little things. You know, we did a lot of rehab when he was out here too, and really try to work on making sure that his body was in tip-top shape. And, you know, if you play this sport, you're never going to be 100% healthy. That's just, you know, that's just the way it is. And the best way I can explain it is just imagine being in a car accident a whole bunch of times in one day. That's basically what this sport is. And, you know, no one's body is made for that. And so how do you take care of it, and how do you prep it, and how do you try to take hits to where you can sustain them and yet not get a lot of injuries. And so there's a lot of little things that you can do as far as, you know, while taking a hit, how you can rotate your body and do some different things so that way you're not separating your shoulder or, you know what I mean, getting your knee bone out. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's in God's hands. And if that's what's going to happen, that's what's going to happen. But there are some little things that you could do to try to prevent that. And so, you know, those are all little things we talk about and try to work on. And, you know, I think he had a good week and a half here and, you know, really utilized his time well and was 100% bought in, which he always is. And so, you know, I thought he definitely was throwing better at the end of the week. Not that he was throwing bad at the beginning of the week. I just thought, you know, it was a lot easier for him at the end of the week. And, you know, his stroke was really fluent. So
he's definitely a guy who seems like he's not satisfied with his retro freshman season and wants to keep improving on it and really does, you know, is willing to put in the work.
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing you're never going to have to ask him to do or try to motivate him to do is work harder than anyone else. I mean, you know, I know a lot of people, everyone says that about a kid, but this is a kid that, you know, truly wants to be the best and will do whatever it takes to get there, whether that means sacrificing his own body or, you know, whatever it takes to put his team first and win games. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, a lot of people doubted him. And, you know, said a lot of stupid, you know, comments about, you know, well, he's maybe not too, you know, that he doesn't understand the game or, you know, he's an athlete that can't throw in the pot. You know, there's just been a lot of things said. I think he quieted a lot of those critics last year when he showed, you know, how poised he was. And, you know, if anyone could say that he, you know, who was the best pocket passer in college football, I mean, his name would have to be in there just because of the fact that he would sit in there and just take, I mean, bad hits. I mean, hits that you don't want to take that 99% of quarterbacks would not take, and he did it and delivered some really good footballs doing it. And so, you know, I guarantee on all those scouts boards in the NFL, they're saying, well, there's one thing that we don't have to worry about is how, you know, mentally and physically tough he is.
You've mentioned his toughness, and you mentioned in pretty glowing terms the type of person that you think he is. Just the general quarterback, what are DeAndre's strengths and what immediately jumps out to you when you're just evaluating the quarterback?
I think his willingness to compete in any type of situation is, you know, something that is, you know, hard to find in a lot of kids, especially nowadays because a lot of things are just handed to people. In his situation, nothing was handed to him. He had to earn everything. And, you know, he just has that it factor. When you look at a quarterback, you mean, you either have it or you don't. You might be able to throw a ball great in shorts and T-shirt. You might understand the game on the board, but not be physically, you know, as gifted as someone else. DeAndre is kind of a complete player. Even though he's not 6'4", he doesn't need to be because, I mean, you know, he's playing at Florida State, who have some big linemen. He finds the holes needed to make the throws. I just think his, you know, he has that no flinch mentality. Like there's nothing that's going to make him the moment too big for him. There's no moment that's too big for him, in my opinion. Like didn't matter if it was a national championship or if they were playing a Division II team, he's going to play with the same passion and he's going to play with the same aggressiveness to try to put his team at the top. And I think that, you know, that's hard to find nowadays. It really is. I mean, I have a lot of good quarterbacks that don't have that same mentality that I work with. And then there's a few others that do. And, you know, DeAndre is just, he's really special to me, not only as a football player, but like I stated, as a human being. And I think that, you know, that goes a long way in life because eventually football will be over and who he will become after that will probably shock a lot of people because he's just a great human being.
We're joined tonight by Dennis Jowell. Dennis is can be found online at QBAcademy.com, can be found on Twitter at QB Academy. And want to go ahead and give your business phone number out there as well for our listeners tonight, 602-692-1668.
Dennis, last year against ranked teams, obviously facing a lot of pass rush, the accuracy struggled a little bit, which is totally understandable for a redshirt freshman. You mentioned earlier completing the throw. Is that sort of the area where you think the accuracy improvement can most come from with DeAndre, or is there some sort of, you know, other aspect of his game that you identified and you say, hey, if we get this tweaked a little bit, your completion percentage can shoot way up?
You know, accuracy comes from a lot of little things that you do from, you know, in a terminology in the science world, you know, biomechanics. There's a lot of little things you got to do to be accurate. He has all those tools. When you're a redshirt freshman and you're playing in the ACC in some big games and you're taking numerous hit, after hit after hit after hit and picking yourself up and not making excuses for him, but it could be hard sometimes to complete footballs against, you know, the top-tier talent there is, especially when, you know, he might not get the blocking at times that he, you know, needed to make the throw. And there's times there were some mechanical issues where, you know, he was on his toes instead of putting his cleats in the ground. And these are all things that, that we're working on and we're watching that he's aware of. And like you said, it was just, you know, first time he ever got to really get with live bullets. And it's definitely something he can improve on. And it's definitely something that we worked on, and it's definitely something he's aware of, like you said. So I don't think, I don't think that it was horrible, and I don't think it was as good as it could be, but it's something that I think will get a lot better this year. You know, it's just like anyone. I mean, Tom Brady, his first year, he was good, but he's not as good as he is now. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Whenever you first, you know, go from high school football, especially to where he's playing at, the game is really fast. So the anticipation and the timing is crucial to accuracy. And sometimes you're a little hesitant to throw a ball that you might not be able to. And, you know, that's things that he's, like I said, he's definitely aware of that. And those are things that we watched film and said, look, you're a little bit late on this throw. And it wasn't his accuracy that was wrong. It was his timing. And so he let the ball go a little bit too late when he could have let it go a little bit sooner. And those are all things that are, you know, tough to do, especially when it's your first year with your receivers and, you know, there's not as much work as, you know, this year or even the next year and things like that. Those are things that, you know, he's going to work on, that he's going to get better at, that things that I think he'll be much better at, and the stats will, you know, show that.
Dennis, you mentioned being on his toes instead of sticking your cleats in the ground. Obviously, you can't show us on a radio format, but could you explain to the listeners a little bit more what you mean by that term?
When we talk, you know, and I'm going to talk a little bit in scientific terms where it might not make sense. When you have more cleats in the ground, you have more power. Your VMO is a muscle on the inside of your leg that you're going to use to drive off of. If you're up on your toes and you're off balance, it's hard for you to create power. So the more cleats that you have on the ground, the more power that you can create, the more balanced that you'll be. So that way, when you turn ground force, which means more cleats in the ground, into rotational force, when you're bringing your back foot through and firing the hip, you can create more power that way, to where it makes it easier for you to throw the ball in your upper body. Because playing the quarterback position, you got to really be able to separate your lower body from your upper body. And even your left side from your right side. And so there's a lot of little things that starts it, you know, that whole process off. But the main thing is those cleats will give you the power that you need. Like I always tell people, if you were meant to play this position on your toes, they would have a separate cleat for you for a quarterback, and it would only have cleats in the front of the shoe. You know what I mean? These engineers and these guys that are rocket scientists that are helping making these things, they understand what all these things are. And so that's why there's, you know, 18 or 16 or 14 cleats in the shoe and not, you know, four in the front. And so that, you know, something that he would do is try to be up on his toes. And, you know, I don't know why, or, you know, who's telling him that, or, you know, if anyone's telling him that, but a lot of guys are comfortable with that. Because, you know, people tell him you need to play taller in the pocket, where, you know, that's not the case at all. You watch someone like Drew Brees, who's 5'10" and 3/4". He plays with one of the best bases in the NFL. And he's the shortest quarterback to do it, and he's still one of the most successful. So, you know, there's a right way of doing it and a wrong way of doing it, and it makes it tougher on you when you're doing it the wrong way. Just imagine trying to play golf on your toes. That's the best way I can explain it. It'd be almost impossible. Those two positions are a lot alike in the biomechanics world, the way we use our lower body, the way we come through, the way you follow through with the upper body. Just you use your arm a little bit different. So that's the best way I can explain it. Imagine playing golf on your toes. It would be really tough.
Awesome. So, Dennis, let's say I had a son, maybe an eighth grader or ninth grader, interested in working with you. What could you kind of describe what your program's like, what you offer to folks?
What I would explain to any parent in the world is that I'm not going to make your son the best footwork guy. I'm not going to make your son the fastest guy in the world, but I'm going to help your son become the best him he can be, the best himself. I can't make your son Tom Brady or Aaron Rodgers, but I can help him throw the ball as good as he possibly can. And I think that's the most important thing. That's what this position is about. All the learning and teaching and all that stuff comes with it. But the thing that I'm going to focus on when you leave is your son's going to be able to throw a football better, and it's going to be easier than what it was before. And I think that's the main thing that I focus on. How many situations can I put him in and make him uncomfortable, you know, on and off platform, in and out of the pocket, to where he can throw the ball just as good as anyone he's competing against? And I think that's, you know, the number one thing I focus on. There are a lot of other things, teaching the game and understanding defenses and what guys' true responsibilities are and protections and defensive fronts and zone dogs and blitzes and all these different things. Yes, but at the end of the day, that's the coach's job. My job as a quarterback coach is to help you throw the ball better. If I'm not doing that, then I don't really feel like I'm doing my job. And, you know, I'm lucky enough to be able to still throw the ball to where I can still show these kids, you know, how to do it and not just tell them that. So, you know, that's the thing that I think differs a little bit from, you know, my quarterback training from maybe someone else's.
Ingram, I know you had a question about the appropriate age.
I did. I have two questions for you. But, Dennis, what do you think is too early, I guess, to take a kid? And where do you feel comfortable with a prospect who's reached an age that you think you could really expand what his capabilities are?
I used to think it was, you know, if you weren't in seventh or eighth grade, that it was too early. But I got to work with my son, who kind of changed my mind on that, and a couple other kids, and I started working with them when they were 10 years old, and they really changed, dramatically, where I thought, you know, this is a drastic change compared to what I thought it was going to be, and I didn't think they'd be able to, you know, really be able to retain that information to where, you know, what I'm trying to give them. Because I don't care if you're 10 years old or you're Tom Brady. I'm trying to teach you to be the best. So I'm going to teach you the same exact thing. I'm not going to say, listen, well, you're only 10, so I'm going to teach you something different. No, these kids have taught me, you know, have opened my eyes and taught me, like, listen, if you teach a kid something the right way when they're young, then there's nothing to fix. And they can, you know, they can retain it. Now, are they going to be able to throw as good as a kid that's 16 or 17? No, because they probably don't have the power. But the, you know, the essential mechanics and the things that are necessary to get them to where they can throw better. You know, my son, you know, he kind of proved it to me, because I didn't want to be the dad that overdid it and my son got worn out. But, he kind of proved to me that he could do it and not get, you know, too crazy or, you know, upset when things are going wrong, especially, you know, how hard it is to work with your own kid. And, you know, he was blessed and lucky enough to win the, you know, sixth grade Heisman Trophy this past year. So, you know, I really opened it up where I think, you know, 10 and 11 year olds is a good starting age, because I've seen it happen with four or five kids where they got, you know, they got a lot better, and they were able to, you know, really pay attention and listen to what I was saying in an hour and 30 minute session, to where I didn't think they would be able to listen for more than 20 minutes. So, that's kind of the starting age now that I've went to. And, you know, I'm not doing it 4 or 5 days a week, but, you know, a couple, 2-3 days a week, especially in the off season, you can help them, you know, dramatically improve their throwing motion.
Another question that I had, and you, I think, answered this inadvertently a second ago, but what do you think, like, the evolution of the quarterback position that we've seen over the past 5 or 8 years and the introduction of run-pass options, how do you see that impact the future of quarterback academies and the private quarterback coach in general?
You know, I've past 2 or 3 years, I've dealt with a lot of dual threat kids that, you know, are really coming to me to try to improve their upper body, you know, throwing mechanics and that kind of stuff. And it's, I mean, I'm going to be honest, I try to teach every one of those guys, let's not use your athleticism at all until you absolutely need to. Let's try to throw the ball better. Let's really look at the game. And there's only been a couple of guys that are true dual threat type of guys that have won any type of major championships or Super Bowls. The guys that are winning consistently are pro style quarterbacks. Tom Brady, Matt Ryan, Drew Brees, Peyton Manning. I mean, Dan Marino, John Elway, Joe Montana. You know what I mean? There's only a couple of guys that have won Super Bowls, like Steve Young, and I mean, even Russell Wilson. I mean, he won a Super Bowl and he ran around, but he was really good in the pocket, didn't turn the ball over a lot, and they had probably the best defense in the NFL. But I mean, Deshaun Watson can run the ball, but Deshaun Watson was super impressive in the pocket. And if he wasn't, I don't think they could have won it, because I mean, he threw for 500 yards or whatever it was, you know, 2 years ago, 2 years in a row against Alabama. I mean, my stats might be a little bit off, but it was like incredible the stats he had throwing against those teams, because no one else could do that. You know what I mean? No one. He was the only one. So it wasn't exactly what made him do that. It was his, you know, presence in the pocket, him understanding the game and where he had to put the ball. And obviously his timing had to be impeccable when you have a defensive pass rush and DBs like they have. And so, you know, I'm not a huge believer in the dual threat thing, because until that takes over and starts winning championships, you know, I'm a firm believer in the guys that are going to win championships are the guys that do their job. Their job is to throw the football and navigate the offense. Their job is not running back. You know what I mean? That's not their job. And you're putting them in a situation where they're probably going to get injured. You know what I mean? And, you know, I think Tyrod Taylor is a perfect example of, you know, someone that I've worked with. And I think that he runs the ball really well. And at times I think he shouldn't run the ball. But his game in the pocket has been pretty good for what he's been dealt over the past couple of years. And I think that he's opened a lot of people's eyes at 6 foot of how good he can throw a ball. Especially because he's really intelligent and he understands the game. So, you know, I understand that a lot of colleges are going to that, but I can't see NFL teams going to that, because every time they've tried it, it hasn't worked. You know what I mean? It has not worked. The reason why the college guys do it and they are successful with it is because a lot of those kids are undisciplined at times. And the NFL is not a lot. There's not a lot of guys being undisciplined. They're disciplined. They understand what they're supposed to do. They understand their schemes. They stay in their lanes and they hit really hard and they're getting paid lots of money and they want to keep their jobs. So, you know what I mean? They don't do a lot of, you know, things that are outside of what they've been taught. And it's just the angles and the speed are too much for that in the NFL. So, I mean, I get where they're going with it at times, but at times I'm just like, you know what? I don't agree with that. And, you know, is Lamar Jackson extremely talented and unreal? I mean, probably the most talented guy in the country as far as physical ability, but how will that play out in the NFL? Will he ever get a chance to play there if he can't be more consistent inside the pocket?
Oh, Dennis, by the way, I have a clip I want to send you. It's of Marcus Mariota with the Titans, and they're facing, I think, Indianapolis. I got to find it. They run a zone read type play. The backer gets influenced by the guard, ends up getting washed by one of the linemen coming down, gets up, and still makes the tackle like 6 yards downfield. And my first thought was just, oh, my God. Like, in college, he's walking into the end zone. And in the NFL, they totally, you know, just totally fake out the guy they need to fake out, and yet it's a 6 yard gain with a hit.
Yeah, it's because guys are, I mean, they're just as athletic. I mean, it's not, the game is not like 1972 when my uncle played on the undefeated Dolphins, where, you know what I mean, they had to find ways to beat teams mentally, and that was the only way they could win, because their talent level was maybe not as good as the other team. These guys are freak. You go to the opening every year, you go to Elite 11, you go to the big time football games. These kids nowadays it's insane how athletic they are. It's nuts. And they're big and they're strong and they're fast and they're mean and it's the game just every year gets, you know, crazier and crazier. I mean, that's why they put all these rules in here about all these hits and stuff, because these guys could really hurt people. Like it's, I don't know what it is in the water in some of these states like Florida and stuff, but these kids are just, they're born just freaks. Like you said, it's unreal. I've never seen anything like it.
Absolutely. Hey, if you don't have a good answer for this, we'll edit it out. No big deal. I know you always like to give a shout out to the guys who maybe aren't as well known as, you know, as a DeAndre Francois. Is there anybody you're working with right now who you think is going to maybe blow up on the college scene this season who maybe we're not so aware of?
I mean, I don't think that he's not, you know, known, but I mean, Brogan Roback at Eastern Michigan reminds me a lot of Brett Favre. Just a cannon of an arm. Has that dog in him. The willingness to win. He loves the game. He's all in. I mean, obviously we talked about Kyle Allen. I think Kyle Allen is a 10-year NFL veteran. I mean, and I'll keep saying that. And I told Bud that from day one. I think that kid is, you know, I just think he's special. I think he's, if you want to talk about a total package, I mean, that's the guy. He's extremely, extremely good. I think you guys should watch out for Brian Lewerke at Michigan State. He's another one that's, you know, he got a little bit of time and he was 8-for-9 against Michigan until he broke his leg last year. And in the first game, he got a chance to play in, I think, and he'll be the starter this year. I think this is going to shock a lot of people. I think Manny Wilkins at Arizona State, I think he'll be the starter. I think he's earned that, you know, right already through spring ball and, you know, a lot of talk about Blake Barnett coming in, but I really think that he'll be the starter. And I think that he'll, I mean, he had a good first five games until he started getting the injury bug last year and he was on fire. And this kid is not only super talented athletically, but he's gotten a lot better throwing the football, a lot better, like tremendously better. And, you know, coming out of high school, I told him, we got to work on this. This is something that you have to improve on. You have to be able to throw the ball better if you ever want to play college football. And I think he's, you know, he's definitely exceeded my expectations of that. You know, I can go on and on and on about kids. I mean, I think Brandon Harris and Malik Zaire will be something, you know, to really watch. I'm really interested to see in how those two, you know, do. Those are two kids that I work with that I think could have really good seasons. Now, they have to do it, but I think that, you know, the situations that they're in now, they're both at really good programs. They both have great quarterback coaches, and they both have the ability to play at a high level. So it'll be interesting. I'm really excited to see those two play. If A.J. Bush gets to start at Virginia Tech, you want to talk about a dual threat kid that's a freak. He's a 6'4", left-handed type Michael Vick kid. I don't know if he's the starter or not, but if he does get the starting nod, I think that's a kid that's going to be extremely exciting to watch. Not as athletic as Lamar Jackson, but reminds me like of a left-handed Lamar Jackson, especially with the kid's arm strength. It's out of control. I mean, he has a cannon. I mean, I could go on and on and on about kids that I think could have great seasons. But
no,
you know,
man,
we don't have all night.
Great. So yeah. You already gave us, over 30 minutes on this, you've been really generous with this. Ingram, you got anything else?
No, I just want to thank you, Dennis. It was incredibly informative. I want to remind people again that they can go to qbacademy.com or follow you on Twitter, which is at qbacademy. And thank you for your insight. And that was a great look at your experience and some of the players you've come across.
Yeah, anytime, guys. Like I said, I've had a relationship with Bud for a while now. I like him. He's a good guy. And anytime I can help you guys out or, you know, help a kid out, that's why I do it. So you guys can feel free to call me at any time.
Definitely, man. All right. We will be in touch, Dennis. I appreciate it. And thanks for being on the Nolcast with Louisiana Hot Sauce Hotline.
No problem, guys. You guys take it easy.
Ingram, that was a delicious interview. Just like Louisiana Hot Sauce is delicious and makes any food even more so.
Absolutely. That was great, man. You know, we aren't huge on getting guests. We did one year where we got a guest about once a week, and it just wasn't great. One night in particular, I remember wanting to somehow be able to morph myself that I could travel through the electronics and then come through the other end and just beat the hell out of whoever it was that we had who was literally sounded like he was doing the interview from like a massive restaurant's dish pit or something like that. I wasn't sure, but that I thought was incredibly informative. Great to hear somebody as highly regarded as Dennis in the QB field and obviously particularly of interest to Florida State fans with his relationship with DeAndre Francois there as well.
Absolutely. So let's pivot from our Dennis Guile interview to some questions about recruiting in our segment that we're going to call the Madison Social Hour, because we are brought to you, of course, by the trio of restaurants, of the For the Table restaurant group, being Madison Social, Central, and Township. Madison being the kind of upscale sports pub, Central, a really great Italian concept, and Township, which is a bit of a beer garden, a really cool place there. So we're going to call this our Madison Social Hour here because it's social media questions that we get. You can always hit us on Twitter at Nolcast, and we do check that quite often. So first one here, Ingram. With Miami surging in recruiting, is there an added importance to this year's game to check that momentum, or will the outcome really matter?
I think there's always, I mean, there's always a lot of importance when you're talking about Florida State playing its in-state rivals, and that's why this run that Florida State's gone on has been as impactful and meaningful as it has. But Miami has a little bit of energy behind the program. I would say more than the program in Gainesville does. So if you could point to one particular game that would stop a potential in-state power or one of the big threes in the state of Florida's momentum, then yeah, you choose the Miami game. But Miami doesn't particularly scare me. I mean, Miami, it's not uncommon for them to have a great recruiting class at this point in the year, and it's not uncommon for them to not have a great recruiting class at the point of the year where it really matters. So I'm sure Richt will be a big boost to their recruiting and will be able to add some teeth to their recruiting efforts. But Miami having an elite recruiting class before the season starts is not necessarily a like wild statistical outlier or anything. It's not all that uncommon at all.
Absolutely. I think you're right on that. But I do think that Miami's recruiting class is better than normal. And I actually like some of the players in Miami's recruiting class this year, whereas in previous years, I'd only like some of them.
Right.
It is always good if you're FSU to kind of stomp out the mysticism that comes with Miami's offseason, right? It's always, oh, they're going to be back to the time mm-hmm. before HDTV, you know, back to the time before the iPhone, back to all those times back when Miami was actually good, back to when they had their own stadium, back to when they had fans, more than just a couple. But if you can squash that and be like, by the way, you guys realize you actually have to play the season, right? Football, the off season, the key word there is off, because during the actual season, you have to play games, and you're probably going to lose some games. So I do think that the game is maybe more important than in recent years, but I don't think it's like massively more so. You don't want to start 0-2, though, and considering you're going to be underdogs to Alabama by, it looks in Vegas now, at least a touchdown, you know, you're more likely to lose the Alabama game than you are to win it. And then your next game against a Power 5 opponent is Miami. So you do want to have that game. Certainly, that would be 2-0, but you definitely don't want to, you want to start 2-1 or 3-0, not 1-2. So, yeah, I think it matters some.
All right, Bud, we have another question here. This is a great question and one that I think a subject that we're probably more honest about than the vast majority of podcasts or just pieces of media of our size. We tend to have a little bit more of a straightforward conversation when it comes to this subject. The question is, do recruits who commit early rather than late receive less quote unquote benefits from bag men?
You know, it's a really interesting question. I think the general answer is yes. Now, granted, if the ones that commit early will receive payments essentially to not visit elsewhere, right? That's kind of how it's like, I've been committed for so long, but now I'm starting to think about some other schools. Oftentimes that's basically like, hey, pay me. So all of a sudden I decide to reaffirm my commitment and not go to other schools. But let me give you a hypothetical here. And by the way, you guys should go read Meet the Bag Man by Stephen Godfrey. It's an excellent, excellent piece. He talked to a number of like basically just bag men across the Southeast for this. He published it, I think, in 2013. Or 2014, I forget which, but it's really one of the best college ball pieces you would ever read. So Google Meet the Bag Man. Let me paint you a scenario here, right? Eric, You play poker?
I play a little bit of poker, not a ton though. You're certainly more familiar with poker than I am.
All right, so here's the deal. In poker, if you show your hand too early, right? But maybe by overbetting early on or representing a super strong hand, you may win the hand. But a lot of people are probably going to fold. They're going to say, well, okay, I don't like what that guy's showing there. I'm going to get out of this hand. So you're not really extracting maximum possible value from the hand. You're not slowly and gradually building the pot to the great crescendo, extracting value from all possible players. The way to really get paid out as a recruit, okay, is to maintain a lot of favorites. Being reasonable about it, of course, right? You're not going to have a top 20, but making multiple schools believe they have an actual shot to sign you is the absolute key to really getting paid out. Because, look, let's say you're a top flight quarterback. You may get $400,000 from a school that you eventually sign with, and that's great. But what if you can get $200,000 from five schools? That sounds a lot better to me. And you know they're not going to snitch on each other. Because if they do, they're turning themselves in too.
Yeah, because everybody's got their hands dirty. Absolutely.
So the way to do it is to make multiple schools believe that they're really in it. After each of your visits, you should leave that school and you should leave them thinking, okay, we don't have him locked up, but I like where we sit. Mm-hmm. And after you go to the next school, I want the next staff to feel the exact same way and the exact same way. You know, I would love it if I was like a top quarterback. And all of a sudden, I had a bunch of SEC teams that actually needed a quarterback, and I was kind of in their backyard, and maybe throwing a Pac-12 team as well, right? And, you know, you're like, I don't know where I'm going to go to school yet. Let me visit all these schools, maybe visit them again, you know, kind of play everything close to the vest. Every time you go to a school, that school's media, they're like local recruiting guys for Scout or 247 Arrivals. They're like, okay, I think we're in the top two. It's this and
exactly
and this
exactly.
other school. You got to tell these schools what they want to hear if you're trying to get max value, which I think you should, because as soon as you put pen to paper, you lose all your leverage. And, you know, if you tear your knee up in college, you're kind of screwed. So you should definitely try to get the maximum amount of money out of this. And for people who are uncomfortable with this, I'm sorry. It's not true amateur athletics. It's just under the table professionalism, which kind of sucks because usually like your shady uncle or street agent will take too much of a cut and some of the money won't get to a kid's family, which kind of sucks. Anyway, that's just purely hypothetical, by the way. I'm not implying anything there with that hypothetical scenario, but it is much better if you can get some money from a bunch of different schools.
Absolutely. The more people that you have believing that they have a legitimate outcome, and the more people that you have who maybe have to go coach has to make an effort to pass the hat with an honest that he believes he has an honest option of really securing your services, then yeah, that is exactly how you drive maximum value, and that is it. I will say there's some prospects every year that you can look at and kind of tell by their visits and just general updates. And then there's a lot of kids who I think just get with a school and have a relationship, and it's just taken care of, and it's not a story that you ever hear. It's a kid that commits at his junior year, and his mother secures a job, and there may be, you know, one or two other benefits, but kind of all parties are comfortable, and that's where you'll have a kid commit, and more or less you won't really have the issue of recruiting pop up again. So it's a good question. It's one that I'm glad that we can talk about and have a grown-up conversation. And like you said, if this like bothers you to listen to or anything, I can understand that. But it's just the flat. I mean, trust me. And we gave a very PG interpretation of a lot of what goes on. But it's just the fact, and it's how a lot of these kids ultimately make their decisions.
It's also very difficult to maintain doing this with like five or six different schools, right? Because most coaches will get wise to this eventually, unless the prospect is just so good mm-hmm. that they can't afford not to believe it.
Exactly. If you're a quarterback, if you're a running back, if you're a defensive tackle or a defensive end, I think you can do this you've got a hell of a lot more leverage. If you are one of the few players on the field that a coach thinks can absolutely win them games, then I think you can drive maximum value at a level that a lot of other positions can't.
Now, let me say this. As a coach, you do not want to go past the hat and miss, right? So you have to make these coaches who are pretty wise, they've done this a lot longer than you as a prospect have, you really got to make them believe. This is a hard sell job. And so you have to have somebody smart managing your recruitment. Usually kids don't orchestrate this on their own. It's almost always like a smart parent or a smart like family advisor or uncle type. But yeah, it certainly is done. And I think it could be playing out this year. Who knows?
Do you expect FSU to have a quarterback committed by September 1st? And if so, who?
Ooh, that's a tough question. I don't know. I feel like I'm flipping coins here. Obviously, Justin Fields is number one on their board still by a mile. I did have an FSU commit tell me that Matt Corral is trying to visit Florida State. He is the kid who decommitted from USC / I'm pretty sure USC actually dropped him. Was at Oaks Christian and is now at Poly, which is actually where Malik Henry ended up after he transferred back from IMG. After TMZ reported that he was in some kind of scuffle with Wayne Gretzky's son at Oaks Christian. Wayne Gretzky has obviously given a lot of money to that school, given that he's had three kids go there. So don't know what the situation there is with that. It looks like Corral is mostly Georgia or Florida, but they are also chasing Fields as well. He's a very good prospect in his own right, a five-star, one of the best in the country. So that's a little situation I'm watching. September 1st is, what, 6 weeks away?
Yeah, day before Alabama game.
I'm going to say if Fields commits before like mid-August, then the answer is yes, because I think it'll either be Justin Fields or a backup plan that they go to and give the green light to commit and get him. If Fields is still on the board and still making FSU believe they have a legitimate shot, which I think right now they do have a legitimate shot, despite the rumors that he's a silent commit to Georgia. And I believe he has legit Georgia interest, by the way. I don't think that's all BS, but I think he has interest in a lot of different schools. Real interest. But if he is still on the board, I'm not so sure they're going to move on to somebody else at this point. As long as they are still believing they have a shot with him, because I think he is that good of a prospect that you do wait.
Yeah. I more and more get the feeling that Fields' commitment is going to continue to linger. So we'll see. I know he had talked about making the decision in August, but right now I would expect this to go a little bit longer than expected, or at least longer than first talked about.
I can buy that.
All right, guys, a little bit of honest recruiting talk there. Let's take a second here to thank our friends from Madison Social. We always are fortunate to be able to pair with Madison Social, and they've been with us since day one, and always have something going on. And that's one of the reasons why this makes it so easy to be able to brag on our partner, because they're not stale, they're not stagnant. They're always looking to have fresh new things, and one of the more recent ones that they have coming down the pipe is a Madison Social tequila crawl. So Madison Social is hosting a tequila crawl with Central and Township on Saturday in honor of National Tequila Day. Tequila Day is actually Monday, but tequila and Monday is far inferior, or significantly inferior, when compared to tequila and Saturday. So they have moved it to the weekend, and it will it's a great opportunity just to go have a good time, enjoy a little bit of food, and have a sampling of tequila that wouldn't otherwise be available.
That sounds delicious. So pretty cool Saturday they have planned for us. I'm definitely all about that. Monday, July 24th, the Tequila Day Bar Crawl. I'm actually pretty cool with this being on July 22nd. That is very smart by them. So here's what we're going to do. Start at Central, right? Pick up a crawl card, order a margarita pizza, get it like margarita, because you always want a salad base before tequila crawl. Next, head to Township, order the Tequiling Me Softly beer cocktail, and then finish the crawl with Madison Social. And when you order your beer-garita, it'll come with a your Tequiling Me Smalls pint glass, which you can keep as a reward for finishing the crawl. I got to say, man, I really love all the pint glasses that, for the Table Restaurant Group do. It's pretty neat. I've got a little collection going. You can oftentimes order them online, but some you can't. Some you have to get them by completing these tasks, and at the end of these tasks, you will probably be pretty loosened up, and glasses will be limited to the first 144 people that finish that crawl, and that place does some good business, so that will probably happen pretty quick, but make sure you get out there early.
All right, bud, as we mentioned in the beginning of the podcast, we're going to have a little bit of a recruiting-focused and even a position-focused look at recruiting. This is the Jimbo Fisher camp coming up here. Really is kind of the apex of the summer recruiting period for Florida State. And I would say that there's, with the exception of quarterback, there's probably been no position that's been discussed as much recently as wide receiver recruiting. So let's just take a couple minutes and use a piece that you put out today on Tomahawk Nation as a little bit of a guideline, and we'll just have a back and forth as far as where Florida State stands, who's available, and what their board might look like in a couple weeks after the Florida State Jimbo Fisher camps.
Indeed. So, Ingram, how many receivers do you think Florida State's going to take this year?
I would think that they would take – they have to take three. I'd like them to take four, and I would say maybe if everything falls right, they could take as many as five.
That's kind of the conclusion I came to as well. If you look at who they have returning – returning next year, technically, Nyquan Murray, Auden Tate, Devontae Phillips will all be seniors in 2018. But I mean, look, those guys are all draft eligible. I think the chance they all three stay, even if I really can't pinpoint who the guy will be, I think the chance that all three stay is rather slim. So most likely, one will probably turn pro, or something will happen, I'm sure. George Campbell, really can't count on. We've already made the rule about him. We're not going to talk about him much until he actually does something because he's been so injured. We don't want to bash the kid because it's injury. Sophomore Keith Gavin will be a junior in 2018. He could leave after the 2018 season. So you do need to kind of reload your receiver recruiting. They have two commits already in the class, though.
Yeah, they got the Antoine Green kid. I know somebody that you've been on for a while now, and he was part of your – part of your article that you put together of kids that could be ranked or would be ranked shortly thereafter. And sure enough, the 6'3", 195-pound kid out of Rockledge declared for Florida State. And for a kid that at one point was not ranked, pretty decent little offer sheet. Ohio State, Georgia, Tennessee, North Carolina, Ole Miss, ultimately finishing second to Florida State, it would appear, for this signature, or the battle for this signature.
Yeah, but he looks like he's now a three-star, according to some sites. So, okay, I guess. In my experience, like, Florida State, Ohio State, Georgia are not really in the business of chasing three stars 8 months ahead of signing day. Like, if you're going to reach on a kid, usually reach late, not mm-hmm. early.
Right.
They also have DeMarcus Adams, who we discussed on a previous show as well, but for those not familiar, he's basically a slot with plus speed, good acceleration, and they like him. Certainly, he's been a good guy at their camp 2 years in a row. Best offers were Penn State and North Carolina. So they definitely, I think, still need to get two more guys, and they got some good candidates out there.
So somebody that we talked about last time and seems to have picked up in general around the fan base that very much looks to be a recruiting story that ends positively for Florida State is the kid out of the Metro Atlanta, South Metro Atlanta, Stockbridge, Georgia, Marquez Ezard, but a big physical kid, 6'1", 6'2", north of 200 pounds, a guy who's had some interest on both sides of the ball, I believe, from various programs, but by all accounts projects as a wide receiver for Florida State.
Yeah, and Florida State made sure to use their visit to see him. We know that Lawrence Dossie went to his practice and was really checking him out. Look, he's an aggressive player. He's physical. He's just not fast. He is a like prototypical possession guy who's going to – and you need those guys. You need guys who are ball hawks. You got to have good balance. You got to have slots. You got to have big guys. You got to have deep threats. You got to have guys who can make the tough catches. Maybe he can be what Devontae Phillips has never actually become for Florida State. Now, maybe Devontae will become that. I'm not 100% certain that's going to happen at this point in his career. But this is the kid that we told our listeners, hey, Georgia, I know he has no crystal balls for FSU back when we were saying this. I was the first, so I should know. But Georgia's coaches think Florida State's going to win this thing. And that was, I think, 2 weeks ago's show. Since then, a lot of crystal balls have come in on Ezer to Florida State. And he is visiting for camp this week. And I would not be surprised if he did end up committing this week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. He is on commit watch, certainly. Pretty similar prospect, a little bit smaller, but a similar kid out of Pensacola, Jacob Coakland. But 6 foot, 195, 200 pounds. Probably 200 pounds is probably pushing it. But like I said, similar skill set. Coakland might be a little more athletic, but let our listeners know where you think Florida State stands with the in-state prospect here.
You know, he's been mentioning Florida State more often, but Jacob just says so much stuff about recruiting, and he's a nice kid, and I like him. And I think he's a good player, a very good player. Pretty much universally considered the top 100 dude nationally. I think that Florida State is behind at least Florida, maybe Auburn. And I'm not sure how much mutual interest there really is there. I think sometimes kids talk about schools that they're not really going to go to. I can't totally dismiss the idea that Copeland would go to Florida State, but I don't think that he is super in on FSU, just personally.
Tommy Bush is a kid that we've talked about more and more recently, a kid out of Texas. Pretty raw prospect who I know that you've seen a couple times in your travels, but big, tall, kind of that lanky 6'4", 6'5" frame that Florida State fans wouldn't be entirely unfamiliar with seeing on the roster. But a kid who's got pretty impressive physicals in general, but has got pretty impressive foot speed to be that size as well. So intriguing, not polished, but a really intriguing prospect in his own right.
Yeah, he's an upside play. Back when I saw him in February, he was ranked, I think, like outside the top 500 nationally. And I was kind of like, why? I mean, what am I missing here with this dude? And turns out nothing. Just, you know, rankings are kind of behind at this point in the year. And that's understandable to some extent. Certainly back in February, they were behind. Now he got moved up. I think he's in the top 200 or top 150 nationally. 6'4.5", 190. Ran the fastest time at the opening Houston, which is very impressive. A cold day, real cold day. I wish I had a jacket. 4.47. And then he also ran a 4.15 shuttle, which at his size is very impressive. So I like him a lot. So do a lot of other schools, obviously, Florida State being one of them. Now, Baylor is kind of thought to be the leader here. However, I'm not convinced that Baylor is actually going to throw the football all that much or even look all that good throwing the football. And so if they don't look like the Baylor of old, is Baylor going to be able to hold on? Certainly they're the in-state school or one of them that has interest in him. I know Texas likes him as well. But he's already visited Florida State, and that's something to keep an eye on there. I think he has a good connection with them. In fact, if they pull him out of Texas, I think he's the Texas prospect that Florida State might have the best shot to pull in this cycle at the receiver position. The only thing is, he gave that interview about how he cares about, you know, NFL development and whatnot, and 10 drafts under Lawrence Dawsey, you know, a lot of bad luck. 2 draft picks at receiver, 10 drafts. If that's a real important factor to you, do you pick FSU?
Right. Yeah. And if that's a real important factor to you, luck doesn't explain that away. So you're right to point that out. And we'll see if that is really comes to fruition as far as that being something that he really judges the school that he ultimately chooses by.
Absolutely. All right. Next kid I wanted to talk about was Jalen Waddle. He's out of Bel Air, Texas. And Ingram, does that school ring a bell with you?
Yeah. Houston Episcopal? I've heard old Houston Episcopal. Maybe a defensive tackle came out of there last year that ultimately ate some fried chicken and chose Florida State.
Honey fried chicken.
Honey fried chicken.
Good. Yeah, that is true. Yeah. Marvin Wilson's teammate, Jalen Waddle. 5'9.5", 175. I don't know about his top end, but his stop start is really very impressive. He's kind of got, I can't say Peter Warwick because it's not that, but his ability to stop and start is really impressive. Catches the ball pretty well. Can make some contested catches from the slot position. Now he's already visited Florida State once, I believe. He's expected to visit this week again. I know Wilson will be able to show him around some. Now Texas A&M and Oregon are in this, as is Alabama. A&M being the local school there to Houston. He also plays on Fast 7, which is a Houston Fast. Anyway, one of the Houston, I think he's on the red. He used to call it Texas Red, but now they're calling it. Anyway, just trust me that he's on the Adidas 7-on team out of Houston, the good one. And a lot of those guys have chosen Adidas schools, if you catch my drift here. Mm-hmm. Leon O'Neal chose Texas A&M. Josh Moore chose Nebraska. A lot of those guys are choosing Adidas schools. So A&M being in this is worth watching. But look, another visit to Florida State. I can't count FSU out here.
Warren Thompson is a in-state prospect, currently a Oregon commitment. He has kind of openly talked about Florida State and his affection for the program, but another big, long, kind of lean kid. We'll have to see how much that Oregon commitment really sticks. That's not uncommon for a kid at this point to be committed at Auburn, to Oregon. It is uncommon to actually see a signature meet paper in February for a Florida kid in Oregon. So Tampa kid committed 6'4", 6'4.5", 190 pounds. But what else do you think is appropriate to add when talking about Warren Thompson?
Well, tonight he tweeted that he is 100% committed to Oregon.
Okay.
But yet I expect to see him this week at Florida State's camp. So I'll add that. And I'll add that the University of Oregon is not any closer to Tampa now than it was in any previous recruiting cycle. So, but I will say Oregon's doing a better job of getting kids to visit before their official visit. So they actually, when they take their official, is actually their second trip out there. So they are doing better at that, but it's still really far away. And I'm not so sure I see this sticking.
Mm-hmm. Sam Pinckney, kid out of Greenwood, South Carolina. I know somebody that you've expressed some confusion or at least some skepticism as to where he's ranked and how this would be a prospect that has the offers that he does and potentially ranked in the 200s when it comes to not overall ranking, but ranking by position.
Yeah, I don't get this, man. Like, FSU's on him, Georgia, LSU, Vatek. I know South Carolina likes him a lot. Like you tell me that this kid, those schools that I just listed are going to go out of state, but obviously South Carolina's in state, but the rest of them are going to go out of state this early to chase a kid who's the number 219 receiver in the country, or even worse, the number 1,464 player nationally? LSU and FSU and Georgia don't sign kids rated 1464 in the nation.
Right.
Highlight film looks pretty good. 6'3", 200-ish, some production, 133 catches, 1,827 yards, 18 touchdowns over the last two seasons. I don't get it. He's going to camp this week. I want to see him. Maybe there's something I'm missing or something that I don't get. I haven't seen him in person. I'll freely admit that. But, man, if he runs a good time, I can't understand what else people might want. He looks good to me. When I was watching his stuff, because one of our guys sent it to him, I was like, oh, it looks like a 4-star type kid. But who knows? Maybe I'm missing something. Could be. Mm. ESPN doesn't have a ranking on him still. It's July 17th.
Next prospect is Brennan Eagles, but a big physical kid that I believe we've talked about a couple times now out of Houston.
Okay, so Eagles is ridiculous. He's kind of like your David Boston clone before Boston got too yoked up. He's huge. I mean, 6'3.5", 6'4", 215, straight line speed, off the charts. Has enough flexibility relative to his size to where he's not super stiff, catches the ball real well, 5-star. matchup nightmare. I have him on the list because of the fact that he still mentions Florida State. I know he likes Florida State, but I don't know anybody who seriously does this for a living who believes he's going anywhere but Texas. So I don't buy FSU's chance at him, really, but I had to put him on the list because I know people are going to ask, so I just put that in the thing. I said, look, I think this is going to be Texas. I don't have any reason to believe Florida State has a real good shot at signing him. He does still mention Florida State, so we'll leave it on there.
Justin Ross, a kid out of Phoenix City, Alabama, another large, raw wide receiver, pretty impressive physicals. Another kid that's north of 6'4", 200-pound player. Kid who's more of a basketball player than a football player, but kind of new to the game, but has some very intriguing potential, and as such is linked with schools like Florida State, Alabama, Auburn, even Clemson.
Very much, yeah. I like Justin Ross. He wasn't a boss. Ross was not a boss at the opening, but look, it's understandable. He's still learning how to play the position. He just kind of switched from basketball to football. I want to see what he does on the field this year. Great hops, as you would expect. Great size. He mentioned Florida State consistently, but I still think FSU is probably fourth for him behind some order here, probably of Auburn, Bama, and Clemson. Just from what I heard at the opening and what I heard from some Clemson people and some Auburn people. And he was also one of the kids that I had Justin Fields predict where he was going, and Fields told me he was going to go to Auburn. So interesting there.
Last name on the list is Kyrus Jackson, a prospect that we've mentioned a couple times on the Nolcast, and just said that Florida State would be involved with him. Didn't necessarily say that that would be a signature incoming, but Florida State is mentioned with this kid throughout the process, but is kind of on that outside looking in. It's generally regarded that Georgia and Auburn are his top two choices. Jackson is a prospect that's often associated with Fields. Not necessarily that they're a package duo or anything, but that the two might attend together. It's worth noting that Jackson was actually supposed to visit Auburn recently with Fields and a couple other kids that were going over there, and he never made it. Fields did. So Jackson down to Georgia and Auburn. For the most part, Florida State may be kind of off in the distance, but that seems to be the situation with where his recruitment stands currently, and you can correct me if I'm wrong about that.
Okay, so I don't want to sound like a jerk on this, but I really wasn't blown away by Jackson at the opening. Like, I'd heard a lot of good things. He's kind of thick. He's 5'11", athletic. FSU made his top seven, but I don't really feel like they're that hard in it. Maybe we'll see what happens. But I don't really feel like that they're kind of that hard in. I guess we'll see what happens with Fields or if he actually makes it down for another visit. But I got to tell you, man, I wasn't really blown away by Jackson at the opening. So I was a little surprised at his ranking, especially when I'm seeing some of the other rankings this year.
I've seen a decent amount of Jackson's tape. He's an athletic kid. He's an athletic kid in the sense that he's an all-around athlete. I mean, too much, I think, in my opinion, basically saying somebody's an athlete has become, they can run a really nice 40, and that's about that. Jackson is he's a thick player. He's I wouldn't call him a possession wide receiver by any means, but he's not a real burner. And when I call him an all-around athlete, I mean that. Bud, he is a state champion in a sport other than football, and it is one of the more unorthodox sports that I have heard of a football player, particularly a wide receiver, being a state champion. And that is, I was going to have you guess this, but that's really not fair to you, or probably good radio. Roberts. Not bowling, but close. Not if you were to bowl, but rather put it up in the air rather than bowling, that would be a pretty close description of the sport that he's a state champion in. State champion in the shot put.
Really?
As a wide receiver.
Okay, yeah, he is kind of jacked. Huh, that's awesome, dude.
So not that is not a, as I we started to talk about this before in the podcast, I just said, well, I'll save it so that we can have a, so that we can have an actual conversation where you're not familiar with that. We don't have to fake it. But yeah, state champion in the shot put, and that is not something you hear about a wide receiver.
That's that's very surprising. So I feel like that's a pretty good rundown of the receiver recruiting board. We'll see what else happens at camp. We'll see who shows up, who doesn't, and what they say. But right now, I feel like receiver recruiting is in a better spot than it was a couple of weeks ago, where they weren't sure what was going to go on with Josh Moore. I think they were caught off guard by Warren Thompson committing after making that trip out to Oregon. But you know, I'm confident they can get two more of this group and maybe three more. And I think if that happens, they're in a really good spot.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Certainly something we'll continue to monitor and discuss. Excited to see what happens at the Jimbo Fisher camp. Certainly we will cover that thoroughly and have as much information possible. But, Bud, we've kind of reached the fun part of the summer here. We've ACC Media Days, SEC Media Days have come and gone. We're about to have a pretty focused recruiting period with the camps, and then before you know it, summer camp, fall camp will come together, and we'll be talking about actual football practices and getting ready for a small little opening game that's set to take place 15, 20 minutes south of my current physical location.
Yeah, it will be a lot of fun, man. I'm pretty excited to be up there. Maybe we will record, I don't know, like a live episode from the press box or something. We got to talk about that. That'd be kind of cool. So,
kicking around a couple episodes, a couple live ideas. So we'll certainly keep our listenership up to date with what that turns out or how that turns out. But happy to be able to put another one in the books. Good little recruiting rundown, particularly at the wide receiver position, and would encourage people to take a look at the article that you put out today on Tomahawk. And I want to thank our guest, Dennis Guile. He's a fantastic source of information, unique perspective, and just not, you know, that's a unique guest and not something you're going to hear all the time. So I want to thank you in particular for being able to bring him about. And that was just a great little resource and some information that you wouldn't be able to source
otherwise. Yeah, man. We're not huge on guests, like we said, but if they can bring us some information that we really don't have or a real fresh perspective, we'll still do them. And appreciate all y'all listening out there. If you enjoyed it, 5 stars on iTunes, review us on Google Play Music or Stitcher, all those things. Reminder, if you're one of the few people that actually use the SoundCloud app to listen, we strongly recommend that you subscribe to us either on Google Play Music for Android phone or on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, if you have an iPhone. Just in case SoundCloud does go under. If you heard our last episode, they refuted the report that they didn't have enough cash to last until Q4. But if I didn't have enough cash to last until Q4, that's also what I would say. So just to be safe, to make sure you don't miss an episode, give us a subscribe on iTunes or Google Play Music or both.
If I'm over the moon, it's because I'm over you. Day at a time, I'm tickety boo. I don't carry on. The way I used to. Whoop dee doo. If I'm doing great, it's because when I get